We just mentioned some of the ancient manuscripts, some of the older Old Testament manuscripts. We said that lower criticism is called lower because it's more foundational, trying to find that original text on the base of imperfect copies. So you criticize the different manuscripts, and then you try to come up with what you think the original actually said. Higher criticism, we ask the question, well, who was the author, what was the date, the integrity of the book, did Paul really write this, the letter to the Ephesians, that type of thing. Yeah, it's used for both Old and New Testaments. Form criticism was where scholars try to find the supposed oral traditions that lie behind the written documents. This is extremely subjective. You hear a lot of talk about the Q document for the New Testament, and what that means is because the New Testament scholars are biased against the supernatural, they assume that there was an original document with nothing but the sayings of Jesus. So you have no miraculous works there, just the sayings of Jesus. And in those sayings, he never claimed anything supernatural. He just, you know, he didn't claim to be God or Messiah or Savior. And he didn't claim to do miracles and that type of thing. So they argue for this Q document behind it. But because it's very subjective, because the oral tradition almost always ends up looking exactly the way the scholar... You know, if the scholar believes in a non-miracle-working Jesus who happens to be a communist, then, lo and behold, you're going to end up with that original document with a non-miracle-working communist Jesus. So, it's very subjective. Now, having said that, they have stumbled onto a few truths there, because through form criticism, they did begin to find choppy statements in the Greek, in the New Testament, that read better, flow like a poem in the Aramaic, and they found ancient creeds or hymns that were quoted in the New Testament by authors like Paul that were actually ancient creeds that predate the New Testament, the writing of the New Testament. So you end up with 1 Corinthians 15:3-8, an ancient creed that goes right back to decade of Christ's death, and it lists the post-resurrection appearances of Christ. Paul says, I deliver to you what I also received. He's using official rabbinical language there. It's like a rabbi saying, I received this from my teachers, and now I give it to you. And Cephas' name, that's Peter's Aramaic name, and James' name, and so they believe it was when he met with James and Peter in Jerusalem, he and Barnabas, between 33 and 37 A.D. So we have found some things. Another thing is I am open to the possibility that there was an original document that is beneath the Gospels that contained nothing but the sayings of Jesus. But I think all the internal evidence would seem to indicate that that would have been the earlier form or the earliest form of Matthew's gospel. Matthew was a tax collector. He probably would have been selected by Jesus. Traditionally, the gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they were given in that order because the early church said they were written in that order. So this idea that Q was first and then Mark came and then the other gospels after that, really there's no ancient evidence for that. It's all based on the liberal speculation of scholars. But whatever the case, I would not be surprised if the earliest, Papias tells us, he was a pupil of the Apostle John, that Mark originally wrote his gospel in Hebrew, and then as he left Palestine and went to preach to the Greeks, and he left probably because of persecution around 42 A.D., he translated it into Greek, okay? And I think it's possible that not only did he translate it into Greek so they would understand it, but he may have had to put some meat on it. In other words, you could have had just the sayings of Jesus. That's all you would have needed. in the Palestine area before 42 AD, because everybody, you'd have to be an ignoramus not to hear what Jesus did. But once you get out of the Palestine area, you know, news didn't travel that fast back then, and you needed an accurate account of the historical things that Jesus did, the historical. So he may not have just translated, he may also have enlarged it by adding the historical context for those sayings. Whatever the case, and what I'm getting at, if there was a cue, it would probably be Matthew's notes, which that along with memorization would explain the commonalities between the sayings of Jesus found in the four Gospels. But it would also claim, you know, it would have those claims of Jesus that he was the Son of God and the Son of Man, the Messiah, and that he was a miracle worker and all that. So form criticism is something that it's kind of like a nuclear warhead. It's okay if it's in the right hands. You know, if it's the U.S. of A. that's got it, and they have it because they don't want to use it, and by having enough of them, it keeps others from using theirs, then that's a good thing. But form criticism in the hands of a liberal skeptic gives them a blank check, a license to just invent the Jesus after their own choosing. Now, the documentary hypothesis, which we're going to spend a lot of time talking about, it's the theory that the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, the five books of Moses, was actually a compilation of different written documents composed by different authors at different places and different times long after Moses. Okay? Now, the reason why they came up with this view, because of the common liberal bias shared by liberal scholars, that of atheistic evolution, they believe that revelation, you know, God revealing himself, prophecy, miracles are impossible. Okay? So with that bias, automatically it would make you, you know, nobody would want to call, if this Moses guy existed, nobody would want to call him a liar. And so it makes it easier for them to attack the first five books of the Bible by saying, well, Moses really didn't write it. Four or five guys wrote it, and they wrote it much later than when Moses lived. So I'm not calling Moses a liar. I'm saying these are fairy tales about Moses that aren't really true. They're not based in fact. And there's also, assuming evolution is true, there's the idea that original religion was polytheistic, and that it evolved into monotheism, the belief in one God. So, so they kind of read that into the scriptures, but when in actuality you find, you know, the Jews were monotheistic from the start, and then they fell back into polytheism, and then God would slam them, and there'd be a reform movement, and they'd get back to monotheism, worship of one God. And also now we know that there's never been a documented case of polytheism evolving into monotheism. In fact, what we find is even with the most primitive tribes that are polytheistic, there is almost always some remembrance of what is called original monotheism. Some remembrance that there is one creator God who created all these lesser gods, but we don't know, remember his name, we don't remember how to worship him. In the meantime, we're afraid of these lesser gods because they're evil. And so these guys are actually offering sacrifices to demons out of fear. And so basically the evidence is in favor of the religion of Abel being the original religion of mankind, belief in one creator God and animal sacrifice to appease him. or they're offered to them, at the same time, you'd also throw in the suffering Savior concept of Genesis 3:15, that from the seed of the woman would come one who would crush the head of the serpent while the serpent bit his heel. When that devolved into polytheism, then God said, okay, I'm going to take one of these polytheists, straighten him out. His name is Abraham, I'm going to straighten him out. And since at that time each guy was worshiping, you know, each nation had its own false god or gods, so God said, okay, well then I'll get myself a nation and I'll reveal myself supernaturally to them because these guys are perverting my revelation in nature. And we see that that it's not really so much polytheism evolving into monotheism, but monotheism at the start and then devolving, and then every once in a while there's a reform movement to get it back in the monotheistic area. So what we want to do right now is talk about the documentary hypothesis. Now, we can't cover the entire Old Testament, you know, obviously. So we'll just look at the first five books, then we'll look at the book of Joshua, the sixth book, and then Isaiah and Daniel. And just kind of as an overview, they're probably the eight books or so that are attacked more than any others of the Old Testament. So Gene Ostrock, in 1753, began to argue that different divine names, different names of God, indicated that there were different sources. Okay, he had this view, and it was common. You know, Darwin was not the first evolutionist. You have even ancient Greeks who were evolutionists. Darwin did not invent. Even Darwin's grandfather was an evolutionist. Darwin did not invent evolution. He came up with a theory, a mechanism that made evolution sound more plausible. Okay, but there have always been evolutionists with us. I mean, if you deny the existence of God, that was always the option. And but whatever the case, this one guy argued that back then man had not evolved to the point where he was smart enough to use two or more names of one God. So if you had two different names of God, it had to be two different authors. And so basically, he began to look in the first five books of the Bible, and when God was called Elohim, that was one author. When he was called Yahweh or Jehovah, that was another author. So he broke it down to the Elohim document and the Jehovah document. And there's several problems with that. We'll talk about it later. You know, one is that sometimes God is called Yahweh Elohim. So apparently two guys had to, you know, work together to get that compound name of God. And, you know, one guy wrote Elohim and the other guy added Jehovah to that passage, you know, hundreds of years later. I mean, that doesn't really make sense. I think we also need to understand Elohim is normally speaks of God as the creator, the God of all, the creator of all. Whereas Jehovah points out that now Elohim has entered into a covenant, an agreement, a pact, a treaty with his people, the nation of Israel. So it's kind of like God is the Elohim, but his name is Yahweh. And whatever the case, so that was the first. See, these guys, they've got this anti-supernaturalistic bias. Miracles don't happen. If God exists, he's not a miracle-working God. So once they assume that, this speculation is needed. Okay? And so Ostrock argues that, you know, different divine names point to different sources. Then Wilhelm de Witt argued that... hey, how you doing? He argued that Deuteronomy, the legal code, you know, the second giving of the law, Deuteronomy, was written at the start of Josiah's Reformation, and it was done for the purpose of uniting worship with the Jews in 621 B.C. Now, that was 1806 when DeWitt did this. Now, we'll talk about that a little later, but basically it was the legal code was so advanced that they just assumed. We're on page 19, by the way, if you have your... Okay. It was assumed that the legal code of the book of Deuteronomy was so advanced that it was far beyond the primitive people that they, again, you assume an evolution. These guys are Neanderthals, practically. And they just weren't that smart in 1500 B.C. when Moses was alive.
Didn't
they also
say
they
were
ripped off
in the
code
of Hammurabi?
See, now that's the kind of argument. Back then, they couldn't argue that way because they didn't know that legal code, the Hittite legal code, what they found was as complex, if not more complex, than Deuteronomy. And it predates it. But so now the argument has shifted. But the thing is that it's kind of like we need to argue in this direction, in the direction of more authors for the first five books because of these reasons, these four or five reasons. Well, now every one of those reasons has been refuted. So you would think they would say, okay, now we need to go back to Moses as the author. But instead, it's like, you know, we need to argue against Moses as the author for reasons A, B, C, D, and E. Then they get this proven, and so now it's, well, we need to argue against Moses as the author because of non-A, non-B, non-C, non-D, and non-E. And then after a while you say, wait a minute, are you saying that, you know, if Jews could use only one name for God, then Moses couldn't have written the first five books. But if they could use more than one name for God, then Moses couldn't write. I mean, there's no way, you know, they stacked the deck, so in the end, there's no way Moses could have, you know, but their conclusion is made at the start. Herman Hupfeld, he looked at it. Remember, you had the Elohim document, the Jehovah document, you know, different name for God's got to be a different document, the liberal scholar said. Then they added the Deuteronomy document, the legal code, had to be written by a different author, okay? Well, Herman Hupfeld in 1853, he's divided the Elohim document into E1 and E2. Now, one part later became known as the priestly code. So it was, you know, dealing with the priesthood and sacrifices again. These sacrifices and are so specific and so detailed. Obviously, man's religions were not that complex in the time of Moses, argued the liberal scholars. And so therefore, this priestly code came much later. And finally, it was Abraham Kuhner who gave the order of JEDP in 1869, which became the traditional documentary hypothesis position. The Jehovah document was written first, then the Elohim document after it, the Deuteronomy document after it, and the priestly code was the final thing written. And then Julius Wellhausen supported the JEDP order of the documentary hypothesis with the evolutionary view of religion, that animism, first, you know, the primitive people were afraid of nature, so they began to see spirits in everything, like the rock has a spirit, and the wind has a spirit, and the tree has a spirit, and they were like personal spirits, but then they began to, you know, say, well, their spirit's more powerful than us, but eventually they deified them, and that's polytheism, belief in many gods, okay? And with that eventually evolved into monolatry, where you just worship only one of these gods, and then that eventually evolved into monotheism. And so Wellhausen, because it was after Darwin, you know, once Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859, experts in all different fields said, well, if, you know, if everything is changing, then so is my, then change is happening in my field. So you even had Supreme Court justices starting applying that to the, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes came much later, He applied evolutionary theory to the Constitution, said that the Constitution is an evolving document, and we, the 9 Supreme Court justices, will tell you what it evolved into at any given time. So, in other words, you might as well just take the Constitution and throw it out the window. You got 9 dictators. That was his view. And whatever the case, Bellhausen is considered the father of the documentary hypothesis theory. So all these other guys kind of, just their liberal theories led up to it, and he put the finishing touches on it. Now, let me say this. When you hear a lot of W's pronounced as V's, what does that tell you?
German.
In other words, the leaders, the first guys to start causing doubt about the scriptures were German thinkers. And Germany has led the way, and this is not a compliment. It's a compliment in one sense, but it's not a compliment in another sense. But they have led the way in philosophical, theological, scientific thought. Usually Europe is like 40 to 60 years behind Germany, and America is 40 to 60 years behind Europe. Okay? And if you want to see where Europe is, the common man in Europe is, look at American universities today. And that's where our community colleges will be 10 years from now, and that's where our populace will be 20 years from now. But whatever the case, it's not a coincidence that the first Western nature, the first Western nation to discredit the Bible was the nation that brought on the Holocaust and opened the door for the Nazis and the return of paganism. Nazi religion was neo-paganism of the Helena Blavatsky Theosophical Society type, and the New Age movement today is from the same mold. And but what I'm getting at is, it's not a coincidence there. Once Bible-believing pulpits are stifled in a country, you know, there is always a dictator waiting in the wings, waiting behind the curtains to just reveal himself. And, you know, a lot of people think, it'll never happen here. We've got to remind ourselves Hitler was elected. And whatever the case, the final conclusion was this, that the Jehovah document, instead of being written around 1450 B.C., 1450 to 1410 B.C. by Moses, the first 5 books were written by 4 different authors at 4 different times and 4 different places. The Jehovah document was written about 850 B.C., the Elohim document 750 B.C., the Deuteronomy document 621 B.C., and the Priestly Code from 570 to 530 B.C., okay? Now, what I want to do is show some of the problems with this particular view. And this, by the way, is not just in liberal Christian groups. You also find this very common in Reform Jewish circles as well, the liberal Jewish groups. Basically, in refutation of documentary hypothesis, 20th century scholarship, and now we're entering the 21st century, but 20th century scholarship has repudiated this view. It has refuted the view. It's, I mean, you don't even have to have evangelical scholars. Non-evangelical scholars have refuted this view. Unfortunately, rather than say, well, this view doesn't hold any order, doesn't hold any water, rather than saying we need to go back to the traditional Mosaic authorship, they're inventing more authors. Okay? And, you know, if, I mean, using the same methods, if you wrote a letter to your dad and you wrote dear dad, how you doing, blah, 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 and this and that and all this other stuff. And I miss you, Pop. And then you wrote some of the, well, because you called him dad one time and Pop another time, that means two different authors. And then if you, as you're writing this just informal letter, all of a sudden you say, by the way, here's a list of things that I need. And you give him a list of supplies that you need. Well, now you're given a list. It's a different style of writing than your flowing narrative. So now you got another author there. I mean, so use these same principles on, you know, letters from other people. And there was my professors from Liberty University used to mention that one time they used computers to analyze some of Paul's letters, which now Paul's letters are almost universally accepted, with the exception of, I think, 1st and 2nd Timothy and 1st and 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, because they believe that the church is too organized for too early in the day with the elders and the deacons. And all Paul was doing was just applying what was already being practiced in the synagogue. So, but whatever the case, some he was probably a computer expert and probably didn't have any New Testament scholarship at all, but he took used computer analysis of one of Paul's letters and supposedly proved that three or four different guys wrote the letter. It wasn't really Paul himself. And so what a Christian who was also an expert in computer analysis and that type of thing, what he ended up doing was taking that guy's letter and putting it through computer analysis, and the computer there said there was like two or three different authors of the letter, which basically shows is that, you know, what comes in, what goes in comes out, and if you're programming your computers to invent extra authors because of the change in style, and a computer's got a pretty even personality, like it's a non-personality from beginning to end. But humans are, you know, Moses can put a genealogy over here, and then he can use, you know, other forms of, write narrative and that type of, you know, humans are like that, and computers aren't. So if you program a computer and you tell it that humans can't do that, then it's going to read different authors on a regular basis.
Even when I've written research papers, I find when I'm writing one day, I might be in a slightly different mood, and the whole second page will be different than the first page,
yeah,
based on
who
I'm in or what happened that day or whatever. So.
And good writing, you know, English teachers will tell you, good writing is going to show signs of variety. And if it's the same monotonous thing over and over and over again, nobody's going to even want to read it. So, whatever the case, 20th century scholarship repudiates this view. Unfortunately, it turns to more liberal speculation. Also, there's circular reasoning that is involved here. They assume that revelation is impossible. That's their first principle. And then from there, they argue that the Bible is merely a human book. Well, if revelation is impossible, then the Bible has to be merely a human book. So this is not something they're proving. This is something they're assuming at the start. So they're arguing in a circle. Over the years, since the start of the documentary hypothesis, since it became popular, over the years there's been more and more evidence for unity throughout the first five books of the Bible. So rather than saying, okay, there was one author and it was probably Moses, the evidence of the unity is now explained away with a hypothetical editor. So now it's saying, okay, yeah, we had these four authors, maybe more now, but one guy brought it all together and edited it. And that's why it's so united and it flows as if one author wrote it. Well, maybe it's so united and it flows like one author wrote it because one author did write it. So they don't accept any evidence for the traditional view, and they won't accept any evidence against their view. Okay, and it used to be they believed that all the ancients, you know, couldn't use more than one name for God. But now if you're going to hold to this position and say, well, if he's called Jehovah, that's got to be one author. If he's called Elohim, it's got to be a different author. Because these Jews back then couldn't use more than one name for God. Well, now we know that the Babylonians, the Ugarit people, the Egyptians, the ancient Greeks, the Muslims, obviously doesn't go back as far, it only goes to 600 AD, but you find many ancient peoples that had more than one name for their primary deity. So if they could use more than one name, why couldn't the Jews? So I think it ends up backing them into a corner, because either they say, all right, ancient man could use more than one name for God, and so maybe the Jehovah passages and the Elohim passages were written by the same guy. But they don't want to concede that. If they want to say, well, no, only the Hebrews of all the ancient people couldn't use more than one name for God. Well, that sounds pretty anti-Semitic to me. So it seems like something's got to give there. Yeah. And they assume, this is a real crazy assumption, too. They assume that secular history is always right when it differs with the biblical account. So if they find some historian, some historical writing, that no matter how inaccurate the author may have been proven to be in other areas, if he purports one fact and he gives a different account, contradictory account to that of the Bible, automatically it's assumed that he's right, whereas the Bible, which has a tremendous track record, is automatically assumed to be false. Several key archaeologists have reported that, and Gleason Archer gives their names, Josh McDowell gives their names, several key archaeologists have stated that there have been literally thousands upon thousands of archaeological finds that has added to the credibility and the reliability, historical reliability of both the Old and the New Testaments, but there has yet to be even one archaeological find that has, in an undisputed manner, refuted any report, historical report given in the scripture. So, at this point, I think if the Bible disagrees with some kind of, some other ancient writing, I would side with the Bible. That's where the evidence is, rather than siding with something that's either untested or has been tested and proven to be false in other areas. By the way, Aristotle's dictum was that whenever you deal with ancient literature that claims to be reporting history, always consider the account historical unless you find evidence to discredit it. Okay? So it's kind of like, in our courts, innocent until proven guilty. Historical documents are true, says Aristotle, until proven false. There's no reason to call a historian a liar if you don't have any evidence to base that upon. So, so they go against that. It's kind of like with all of ancient literature, they assume it's true until proven false, except with the Bible, it's always assumed to be false until proven true. They assume the Hebrew religion evolved into monotheism, yet out of all their neighbors, Israel was the only nation to have a true monotheistic faith. All the other nations, if this was the case, the nations that were there before Israel should have already evolved into monotheism. And you'd expect to find other nations evolving into monotheism. That wasn't the case. You can't explain Israel by other nations Because Israel is like a unique case. I mean, God just reached out and plucked Abraham out of polytheism and set him straight. And so Israel's the exception rather than the rule. They often take passages out of context to prove the Bible has contradictions, and they never accept any solutions. There are some passages in Plato's writings where it seems like he contradicts himself. You know, he says something in one paragraph and contradicts himself in the next paragraph. What you do is you give the author you assume that the author has not contradicted himself unless you prove that, okay, yeah, he's contradicted himself. So you just assume that this guy is not so stupid that he's going to contradict himself from one paragraph to the next. So maybe we need to read him closer. Maybe we need to read several of his works to see what he's getting at here. And you know, that's usually a sign of profound thinking. Is often when, and sometimes it's hard to figure out, you know, who's a babbler and who's a genius, because we can't understand either one, you know. But then the longer we study guys, you know, I used to think Cornelius Van Til was a babbler. And even J.P. Moreland agreed with me on that, until I started reading some of his better students, and Bonson and Frame. They admitted, number one, that Van Til was a horrible communicator, but that he was a very profound thinker, and they eventually spelled out his thought in a way that was coherent. But he was just a, you know, very, very complex and profound thinker, but he didn't have the communication skills either in writing or in speaking to really get his points across, so it was easy for a lot of people to misunderstand them. But whatever the case, so these guys will take passages totally out of their context and will accept no resolution whatsoever. They also reject evidence for much Semitic repetition in literature by the same author. This was a poetic device. I mean, you read it in the Psalms, they had all different types of it, where it was a form of Semitic poetry, not just Jewish, but other Middle Eastern nations using repetition. You could just open up Proverbs, where it says things like, let me see if I can just find one just from randomly opening it up. Wait a second, I think there's one. He who begats a scoffer does so to his sorrow, and the father of a fool has no joy. Okay, that's Hebrew parallelism, where it is basically using repetition, repeating either the same exact idea or a very similar idea in different words, and that was one of the form of poetry. In Psalm, I believe it's Psalm 119:45, the Lord is near to all who call on Him. To all who call on Him in truth. It has an A, B, B, C form. Okay, they've got so many different types. I took a course in the book of Psalms, and you really learn about Hebrew poetry there. But on the parallelism, where there's repetition involved, you know, where one line parallels the other, you can say, like, a fool has no knowledge, but the wise man grows in understanding. Well, you're saying the same thing in both lines, but you're coming at it you know, one comes at it from the fool standpoint, the other comes at it from the wise man standpoint, but it's saying the same truth. So you can say A and then the opposite of A, but it's still saying the same truth. Or you could also say a fool hates knowledge, and a stupid man does not learn. And there you're saying the same thing, just in different words, okay? So, the Jews are experts at this. And what I'm getting at is, when you find, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1, and it talks about the 6 days of creation, and then in Genesis 2, and then, you know, God created Adam and Eve, and then, God created man in his image. And then in Genesis 2, it talks about God creating man, and it's more specific there. That doesn't necessarily mean two contradictory accounts, nor does it mean that it has to be, since they're talking about the creation account twice, it has to be two separate authors, okay? I mean, that's just part of Hebrew, the style of writing, where they use parallelism. And the first time it's God created the universe, and he created man at the climax of his creation work. And then Genesis chapter 2, now the focus is zooming in on man, and so we get more details about God creating man. And, you know, that runs throughout ancient Hebrew literature. We know that now. We didn't know that back then. Now we know that, so why do these guys still hold to their liberal views? And so you have this Semitic repetition in literature by the same author. And there's no problem with that. I think the biggest problem here is that they assume they can scientifically reconstruct the text 3,500 years after the fact in a more accurate manner than those who are only, you know, hundreds of years after the fact. I mean, it just boggles the imagination that they could argue that the, you know, ancient Jews really thought that this Moses guy wrote this stuff when they were only, you know, less than 1,000 years after the fact. But now, 2,000 years after that, our geniuses today can tell us, you know. I mean, when it comes to the New Testament, it's even worse. Because you get guys at the Jesus Seminar, 2,000 years after the fact, supposedly they know better what John really wrote than his own pupils, Ignatius and Polycarp. What's wrong with this picture? I mean, that'd be like a guy saying 2,000 years from now that Fernandez taught that Jesus was a three-headed man, and then you find the writings of Carlito and said, no, I sat under Fernandez's teachings and he taught that Jesus was God, the second person of the Trinity, become man, and he only had one head. Why in the world would I believe in a guy 2,000 years after the fact? But, you know, that's part of a lot of liberal scholarship. It's an evolutionary assumption. Newer is better. You know, and even we Christians think that way. I mean, even thinking Christians think that way. You know, we don't go run into the Christian bookstore, as if the Christian bookstore would sell it, to buy Aquinas or Augustine's works, but we'll go run into the Christian bookstore to buy Norman Geisler's latest work. The crazy thing is the guy who's probably more frustrated about that than anybody else is Norman Geisler. Because he recommends that you read Aquinas and Augustine before you even, you know, or maybe read his work first because it's a little easier, and then he can introduce you to the big guns. But we've got this idea, you know, we've got to get the latest thing that's the hottest off the press. And what did Geisler say? So politically incorrect or theologically incorrect here. He said, people asked me, have you read the latest Tim LaHaye book? This is before Tim LaHaye's Left Behind series. And he said, what do you mean, read the latest Tim LaHaye book? He said, I haven't even finished Augustine yet. Because, you know, Augustine wrote so much. But, you know, that's a better attitude, a much better attitude than the attitude that we have, that, you know, if it wasn't written, if the book wasn't written, if it's 2001, if it wasn't written in sometime after 1998, it's outdated. And it's, you know, I mean, we applied that principle to wine, you know, wine experts would freak out. And, now we're going to continue our reputation of the documentary hypothesis by providing some positive evidences for the mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch.